Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, April 18th, 2024. 25 years on, the Jeff Davis County Food Pantry continues to nourish community. Open house set for Saturday by Mary Cantrell, M-K-C-A-N-T-R-E-L-L, at BigBendSentinel.com. Fort Davis. Volunteers are moving quickly, unpacking pallets of fresh produce, loading vegetables into coolers, opening boxes of dried goods, and stocking shelves, while a warehouse garage door remains wide open, ready to welcome incoming delivery trucks. It's one of the Jeff Davis County Food Pantry's busiest days of the week. It's chaotic, yet organized. The shuffling of people and supplies is like a game of Tetris. We try to put everything on wheels, said Executive Director Vicki Gibson. Gibson, armed with a clipboard, supervises deliveries that morning from the West Texas Food Bank and assists volunteers when they have questions, though they mostly work independently. The distribution center bears the name of the organization's founders, John and Brenda Bell, who started the Jeff Davis County Food Pantry 25 years ago. The nonprofit currently serves 530 individuals, representing 235 households, nearly a third of the county. Over half, 57%, of their clients are either under age 18 or over 60. Because Fort Davis schools were built without cafeterias and do not offer free and reduced lunch programs like most public schools, the food pantry also runs school lunch and snack programs, adding to the complexity and cost of its operations. The food pantry provides one lunch and one snack to 118 school-aged children 365 days a year and supplies free snacks at schools and the county library. There's a lot of food insecurity in Jeff Davis County, Gibson said. Among children, it is particularly high. Those are the people we're trying to help. The food pantry is hosting an open house to raise awareness of its mission, show off new building additions, and celebrate its 25th anniversary this Saturday, April 20th, from 4 to 6 p.m. at 609 Compromise Street in Fort Davis. The event also acts as a fundraiser, as the food pantry is experiencing a $50,000 budget deficit this year. Gibson said rather than cut programs, the food pantry board opted to find the necessary funds. In addition to helping feed local kids, the food pantry also runs a senior box program, a curated selection of pantry staples distributed to 50 seniors once a month. It allows its clients more options for receiving food than local grocery stores. Clients can customize their orders online ahead of time, pick up via drive-thru, shop the shelves in person at the distribution center, and receive at-home deliveries. The food pantry also provides free pet food, one of its most popular items among clients. Sometimes that's their lifeline. They're lonely and isolated, and the pets are really important to them, Gibson said. The Jeff Davis County Food Pantry is primarily funded by the FMH and Yarborough Foundations in Midland, as well as individual donors. It receives some federal help in the form of food deliveries from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Of its $284,000 annual budget, $44,500 goes toward producing fresh produce, which is distributed to clients twice a month. Gibson said that Jeff Davis County Food Pantry is one of only a handful of food pantries across the state to purchase fresh produce for their clients, deemed a priority due to poor health outcomes in the county. Because we buy healthy food and fresh produce, we do spend more than most food pantries do, Gibson said. But hey, I've never been of the opinion that people should be grateful for whatever they get if they're living in poverty. There's no reason why they shouldn't have the most healthy ingredients and food. Gibson runs a lean operation. The pantry employs 3 part-time employees, relying heavily on the labor of 15 regular volunteers. We could not do it without our volunteers, Gibson said. Its annual trash bill is under $200. Volunteers recycle boxes and bags whenever possible and take trash to the dump when needed, avoiding the cost of a dumpster. The pantry partners with Mobile Comunidad, another local nonprofit, which delivers food to the school district, county library, and clients, some of whom are homebound, in Valentine and the Davis Mountains Resort. Stephen Chavez, who acts as the transportation manager for Mobile Comunidad, said one of the most meaningful parts of his job is delivering food to the schools and library, knowing children in need are being provided for. I was a deprived kid, my mom being a single mother working, Chavez said. To me, this is personal. It's very refreshing to see that we can do something for the community, he added. There's not enough of this going around these days, and I wish it wasn't that way. Regular food pantry volunteer Diana Wilkinson shares Chavez's personal connection to the organization's mission. She was first introduced to the food pantry as a client when she moved to Fort Davis in 2020 on a wing and a prayer. They fixed me up with all kinds of stuff. I went home crying, Wilson said. I was so ecstatically happy. Wilkinson then started volunteering at the food pantry, where she found support and community. She said spending time at the distribution center with food pantry board members, other volunteers, and clients has given her a sense of feeling needed and wanted. This is my exercise. This is a way for me to actually express myself to other people, Wilkinson said. I am so psyched to help people like I've been helped. Gibson, too, finds satisfaction in her job at the food pantry, which she said makes a real difference in the community, particularly for area youth. Kids can't learn if they're hungry, she said. She is hopeful the push for more donations will help the food pantry cover its current $50,000 budget deficit. If we need more, we get more. It's not like a pie, and we only have so much pie, Gibson said. We just bake a bigger pie or make more pies. For more information or to donate, visit foodpantry-jdc.org. Staff photo by Mary Cantrell. Jeff Davis County Food Pantry volunteer Cruz Martinez loads celery into coolers at the distribution center. Staff photo by Mary Cantrell. Jeff Davis County Food Pantry volunteer Diana Wilkinson opens and unpacks boxes of dried goods for food pantry shelves. Illustration courtesy of Crow Crumbs. The weight of the badge. Customs and Border Protection responds to rash of agent suicides. By Sam Karras. Sam at BigBenSentinel.com. U.S.-Mexico border. As journalists and politicians endlessly dissect the current situation on the southwest border, Customs and Border Protection, CBP, is dealing with the crisis all its own, a spike in suicides among agency staff. The issue was first widely publicized in December of 2022 when 3 Border Patrol agents died by suicide within a month. The agency has been keeping internal tabs since 2007. In that 17-year span, there have been 149 reported deaths, with a spike of 15 in 2008 and 14 in 2022, out of a workforce of around 20,000 Border Patrol agents and 60,000 total employees. These higher suicide rates appear to be correlated with higher numbers of apprehensions along the border and their associated waves of violence, suffering, and death. Widespread criticism of the Biden administration's border security policies has resulted in intense scrutiny from both ends of the political bell curve. CBP families, agents, and whistleblowers agree the job is not easy. A study tracking deaths of law enforcement officers more generally found that life expectancy for those in the line of duty is age 66, 12 years lower than the general population. Working long hours and responding to high-stress situations, our men and women in green and blue are being pushed to their breaking point every single day, Congressman Tony Gonzalez wrote in a press release. In 2022, Gonzalez, who represents the Big Bend, introduced the Taking Actions to Prevent Suicide, TAPS, Act, alongside fellow Texas Representative Henry Cuellar, calling for an anti-suicide task force to identify strengths and weaknesses in the agency's response to the crisis. The bill never made it out of committee. The two representatives wanted to boast what they perceived were positive first steps. Recent appropriations have led to the hiring of additional mental health clinicians at CBP. However, there is still a shortage of mental health support, education, and destigmatization at the agency, he wrote. In May of 2023, the Department of Homeland Security's Office of the Inspector General, OIG, published a report presented to the heads of CBP and ICE that pinned the blame on overwork, as well as poor public image and violence or threats of violence. While the number of agents has remained relatively stable, migrant encounters along the border have ballooned 143% since 2019. 2022 saw a record 800 recorded migrant deaths. The agency also estimates a 303% increase in gotaways, or migrants that were detected but never caught. The result is demoralizing. Half the respondents to the report's survey said they had been asked to take on extra duties, and nearly a quarter struggled with work-life balance. 20% said they felt they were unable to perform their primary law enforcement duties as a result of the extra work. 13% confessed they were struggling with their mental health. Officers are getting burned out, one agent commented. We need more staff and better shifts that allow for more time off with families. Divorce rates and suicides are rampant in the agency. We want to feel like we are respected and not a cog in the machine that can be easily replaced. The department pushed back on some of the report's findings, stressing, above all, that only about 16% of total CBP and ICE employees had actually submitted responses. They also outlined in more detail the resources available to employees, including peer-to-peer counseling, chaplaincy programs, and a suite of mindfulness and anti-suicide apps. Leadership is concerned that the OIG's draft report does not fulsomely recognize the extent of initiatives DHS has implemented to support its personnel, the response reads. The Big Bend Sentinel spoke with Border Patrol agents past and present for more insight into how the agency is succeeding and falling short in its efforts to support its employees' mental health. Battle Buddies. As part of its Shine a Light initiative, CBP hired renowned suicidologist Kent Corso, an Iraq war veteran turned psychologist turned world-renowned mental health consultant, to help illuminate the path. One of Corso's initiatives included recording a podcast that collects stories from within the agency that humanizes the internal struggles many agents face. Corso's work highlights an important truth. There have been exponentially more than 149 people impacted by suicides at CBP since 2007. I find myself waking up to a reality I never asked for, that my kids never asked for, the anonymous widow of a Rio Grande Valley agent told Corso in a podcast interview. He's in peace, but we were left in pieces. The widow, referred to only as Jane Doe, said that confusion was a part of her complicated grieving process. Why hadn't her husband of more than two decades confided in her about his internal struggle? Landon Hutchins, spokesperson for Big Bend Sector Border Patrol, explained that the stressors of the job are inconceivable to civilians, even those closest to the agency. There's a higher threat for danger. Your average civilian doesn't worry about getting shot at by cartels, he said. Agents have to keep their heads on a swivel at all times. Migration to the United States is constantly shifting, too, perhaps making it more difficult for agents to relate to others, even those who have hung up their green uniforms. In the popular imagination, migrants moving across the border are solo young men undertaking epic journeys through the desert, but the reality has changed so much in the past few years that this narrative is due for a rewrite. Both agency data and data collected by advocacy groups suggest that migrants are dying at unprecedented rates in urban areas like downtown El Paso or suburban Sunland Park, New Mexico. Agents who might previously have spent most of their time in an office are now faced with the same reality as their grizzled colleagues in the field. Sometimes you encounter deceased individuals and some pretty gruesome situations, Hutchins said. As a media liaison, Hutchins was also astutely aware of how outsiders' perceptions could have on agents' well-being and self-esteem. I think something that's underreported on is the compassion of your average agent, he said. They're enforcing our immigration laws, which is critical, but I see a tremendous amount of humanitarian compassion. Every agent I know carries a lunchbox with extra food and water they end up giving out to migrants. Women and unaccompanied children have also been crossing the border in higher numbers, tugging on the heartstrings of people in the agency with families of their own. We spend a lot of time away from our families, explained Assistant Chief Patrol Agent Jaime Castillo. We're passionate about our jobs. It can be consuming. You spend a lot of time thinking about work, even when you're gone. While they don't see the same volume of apprehensions as their colleagues up and down river, Border Patrol agents in the Big Bend sector perhaps understand isolation better than anyone else. Agents clock in for at least 50 hours a week, often in remote areas where cell phone service is limited. Many live in agency housing, cut off from the convenience and comforts of home that transplants to the region sorely miss. To counteract the bad press, CBP has been experimenting with recruitment bonuses in its most remote locations. Presidio has been flagged as particularly hard to fill, and now advertises a $30,000 bonus for new agents. Richard Bodegon, Acting Special Operations Supervisor for Big Bend Sector Strategic Communications, said that he had been personally impacted by the agency's mental health crisis. During his time at the remote port town of Santa Teresa, New Mexico, the station was devastated by 3 deaths in the space of a year. One day, he came to the grisly realization that he had been routinely parking next to a patrol vehicle that had been the site of a colleague's death by suicide. Barragan said that he lived by a simple motto, "Be the one." The term was popularized within the agency by a social media campaign, including YouTube and Instagram posts that encourage agents to reach out to each other. In one video, former agent Vincent Vargas asks agents to think back to their academy training in the Battle Buddy system, used to keep tabs on their colleagues in physically dangerous situations. "Look to the left and right of you," he said. "If any of your brothers and sisters are struggling, please reach out to them. Be a battle buddy for them." Paragon said that he'd taken the message to heart. It was a call to action, basically to bring suicidal ideation to the forefront and to remove the stigma of talking about it, he said. "We do internalize a lot of these feelings, and it does help to talk to someone." Both Garagon and Castillo said that they had both taken part in and benefited from the agency's resiliency training, which teaches agents the skills they need to perform in an intensely stressful job. "The training came at a critical point in my personal and professional career," Castillo said. "It turned me around and flipped the switch." In the Big Bend sector, support programs take a number of forms: peer-to-peer counseling, chaplain support, resources for the families of those who pass away in the line of duty. Local agents also have access to canine support animals, meditation, and even yoga classes. Numbers show that the programs are taking off. DHS reports that there are 12,278 supervisors trained in suicide prevention and awareness, with plans to grow these numbers and the scope of their education. In 2022, CBP chaplains sat for 66,000 sessions, 6,000 more sessions than the agency has employees. Castillo says that every effort, whether it's counseling for grieving family members or a few minutes with a furry friend, can make all the difference. "CBP has done a great job of letting us know that they truly care about us," he said. "I felt like I had been on the wrong side of history." Despite the insistence by top brass that the agency's suicide crisis is the result of external factors, former senior patrol agent Jen Budd says the organization itself shares the blame. Budd, an outspoken critic of the agency and author of Against the Wall, which discusses her own suicide attempt, says that a culture of internal intimidation, corruption, and fear has been causing rampant mental health issues for decades, long before the Border Patrol started tracking data or talking openly about these problems. "The culture of the Border Patrol is that if you can't handle it, then you're not tough enough. You're not BP material. You don't bleed green," she said. "In order to admit that they have a suicide problem, they have to admit that they have a cultural problem." She calls herself a part of the old patrol, referring to those who served as Border Patrol agents before 9/11, when the Department of Homeland Security was created and the agency was tucked under its umbrella. For Bud, the difference between the old patrol and new patrol is cultural as much as it is financial, The old patrol embodied macho Western cowboy stereotypes and lack of funding, with agents sometimes having to walk their patrols after they ran out of gas. The new patrol, on the other hand, has been deeply influenced by the Iraq War, both in mindset and billions of dollars in Homeland Security funding. They see it as a combat zone. They see migrants as possible military threats, she said, pointing to the popular use of the word invasion by conservative politicians and commentators. Bud said that she felt all that money pumped into combat technology came at a moral cost. A great deal of her work was physical, hiking up to 16 hours a day. Outside of specially trained details, she said that most of the new patrol does their work from behind a screen, steering drones and monitoring sensors. They don't develop any kind of sympathy from walking behind these people, she said. We sat with their bodies. We went through their pockets. We saw their tattoos. Despite the generation gap, she was there for what she thinks is the first fallen domino in today's border crisis, the building of the wall. As a new recruit, she worked out of Campo Station in the remote mountains of Southern California. The wall reached her sector in 1996, not long after she joined, transforming from a simple barbed wire fence to a massive barrier, funneling people through treacherous terrain. Slowly, she started to realize how shifting government policy was making her daily working reality more difficult to stomach. It was having an impact on her fellow agents, too. As you spend time with the bodies, you start to understand what's really going on, she said. I would see guys falling apart, hardened guys falling apart. What they don't realize is that the federal government is making them do the dirty work. Bud uses the wall as a metaphor for both the state of immigration and the state of her heart. She says that she's been building internal walls of her own since she was a child, trying to survive an abusive family life. Once she donned her Border Patrol uniform, she began taking on other people's pain. Male co-workers seemed more comfortable expressing their anguish to a female agent, fantasizing about suicide, confiding addictions to alcohol, sex, gambling. What I'd do is just eat it all up and throw it over my wall, she said. One day, Bud was cruising alongside the wall in a patrol vehicle when someone from the other side launched a human head into the sky, landing on her windshield. She took it as the first of many signs that it might be time to leave. She had long been suspicious of corruption in the agency. She was raped by a fellow agent during her time in the academy. He faced no consequences. Leadership simply sent him to another station. Bud chucked that shame and trauma over her wall, too, not even confiding what had happened to her wife until years later. Bud finally left after she started investigating a higher-up she suspected of smuggling drugs and was harassed and threatened to the point that she hung up her uniform for good. What she had seen and experienced in the agency stuck with her, particularly an encounter with a migrant with whom she shared water and cigarettes while they waited for transport. "You're a good person," the man said. "I want you to think about what you're doing." She responded with anger at the time, anger that took years to unpack. In 2015, Bud attempted suicide, having felt tortured by the experience for well over a decade. I felt like I had been on the wrong side of history, and I didn't know that I could overcome that, she said. I felt like I just needed to end my life and be done with it. After an extended hospital stay and years of therapy and medication, Bud has channeled her traumatic experiences in Border Patrol into advocacy work, challenging the agency and its union's official narratives. She says that, like her younger self, most people who join the Border Patrol do so because they want to serve their country. More often than not, they aren't aware of the reality of the border and its political history before they join. With time, she's come to fear that a percentage of agents join because the barriers to entry are low and predators face few consequences. Bud was featured in the Project on Government Oversight's report on sexual misconduct and abuse, which revealed that just under half of people who reported sexual abuse in agencies within DHS say they faced professional retaliation as a result. Crimes committed by CBP employees against migrants have made headlines in recent years, from an investigation into whether mounted agents whipped Haitian migrants to a serial killer who claimed the lives of four sex workers. Whether or not agents who commit crimes on a national stage are guilty as charged, Bud says it's mentally devastating to try to enforce the law among people very publicly breaking it. It's a mind F blank blank K, she said. With time, she's been able to dismantle her own walls. I mean, there's a lot of things I loved about the Border Patrol, and I'm really proud of a lot of things I did. I've saved a lot of lives, but at the same time, I'm ashamed of that organization, she said. Both things can be true at the same time. For a handful of local Border Patrol agents, Father Mike Wallins of St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Marfa serves the function of a chaplain, but is not part of the official CBP chaplaincy program. He asked to take part in the agency's resiliency training himself to better understand the resources and potential gaps that are offered to the rank and file. Wallins did not share Bud's overall pessimism about the agency, but did agree that CBP's protocol and culture might prevent some in crisis from reaching out for fear that they might be ostracized or pushed out of their jobs. He treats his sessions with agents like religious confessions, a sort of spiritual HIPAA agreement that ensures he is not required to disclose what agents share with him to their supervisors. Wallins is a Dallas transplant, but has made a niche for himself in the borderlands by fostering connections between the Border Patrol, the local faithful, and the migrants and asylum seekers passing through the Big Bend. He echoed sector leadership in saying that the extreme remoteness of the area carries a psychological weight and encourages agents to throw themselves into community volunteer work to combat feelings of isolation. He says that the agents who come to him wrestle with the same moral dilemmas that pushed Bud to attempt to end her life, a gap between policy and morality. The agents out here, I will say, are filled with compassion. They're put in a position where they have to wrestle with what their heart says versus what the policy says, he explained. Because of those compassionate hearts, it's easier to get wounded. This story is part of a series on mental health in the Big Bend, funded by the Presidio Community Fund. Gunshots lead to lockdown of schools in Alpine, warrant for man's arrest. By Rob D'Amico, rob@bigbensentinel.com. Alpine. An arrest warrant has been issued for an Alpine man who allegedly opened fire on a man's pickup truck Tuesday afternoon, initiating a brief lockdown of Alpine ISD schools, according to police officials. The Tuesday shooting incident is one of several events impacting an Alpine family that has seen a tragic death and the arrest of family members in the past 2 months. In a text and Instagram message to the community, Alpine ISD Superintendent Michelle Reinhardt said the district put schools on a lockdown for about 6 minutes before a return call from police gave her the all clear to remove it. The Alpine Police Department issued a warrant for Juan Jose Tafoya, 30, of Alpine, after he allegedly fired at least 2 shots at a truck owned by Justin Vega Lara, 37, of Alpine, near the 1100 block of North 9th Street, just after 1 p.m. Tuesday, according to Police Chief Daryl Lasoya. Justin Lara is the brother of Ismael Javier I.J. Vega, 23, of Alpine, who died of a suspected fentanyl overdose on February 15th. Authorities in Sierra Blanca then arrested Vega's other brother, Willie Sapo Lara III, and 2 others on March 4th for possession of narcotics, including fentanyl, with intent to distribute. According to a complaint filed in federal court, those arrested said the plan was to sell the fentanyl in Alpine. Justin Lara, the target of Tuesday's assault, was then arrested on March 7th after officers found methamphetamine and marijuana in his vehicle, and he was jailed briefly in Brewster County before being released on bond. According to police officials, the arrest was not directly related to his brother's death or the other brother's arrest, but it was the result of a Department of Public Safety warrant for Justin Lara after he failed to appear as promised to give information to authorities about both of those cases. Justin Lara was detained after the shooting but was not arrested, according to police. The Facebook account of his mother, Marta Vega of Alpine, posted Tuesday blaming Tafoya for the shooting. "I just want to say to Juan Tafoya, you are very lucky the bullet hit my son's truck and not my son," the post stated. "You are a coward." Marta Vega also suffered a suspected fentanyl overdose at the same time her son IJ died, but survived after treatment at the Big Bend Regional Medical Center, according to police and family friends. Police did detain Justin Lara to question him, but he still is considered a victim of the shooting, Lasoya said. Tuesday's shooting is believed to be part of a domestic dispute over a woman who has been involved with both Tafoya and Justin Lara, according to police and the Facebook post on Marta Lara's account. Tafoya shot at Justin Lara from a vehicle, then fled, the police chief said. Police do not want to describe that vehicle because they believe Tafoya has switched to another vehicle. Superintendent Reinhardt said the police called her quickly after the shots were reported, and because of a relative proximity of the shooting to the elementary school, about 0.5 mile, they advised a lockdown. When Reinhardt posted her message to the community on enacting, then lifting the lockdown, she noted that a suspect had been apprehended. Lasoya said that initially police gave her that information because they had arrived at the scene of the shooting and thought that Justin Lara was the shooter. The 911 call from a neighbor noted his white pickup truck as the suspected vehicle used in the shooting. When they apprehended Justin Lara, they gave the all clear to Reinhardt. Reinhardt said that while the incident was not an immediate danger to the elementary campus, it was clear that law enforcement needed to act on it as a precaution and advise the lockdown. "I'm proud of local law enforcement that they were right on top of this and with the immediate notification to schools as a precautionary measure," Reinhardt said. "Our staff did a great job of immediately implementing our emergency procedures. I'm just glad that everyone was safe throughout." Police chase mountain lion through streets of Presidio, by Rob D'Amico. Rob at BigBenSentinel.com. While mountain lions are not uncommon visitors to remote ranches and parks of the Big Bend, it is rare to see them prowling the streets and alleyways of an area neighborhood. But that was the scene on April 9th, as Presidio police officers chased after a lioness, which eventually fled into the wild. A Presidio resident spotted the mountain lion, and two Presidio Police Department officers and an animal control officer responded to the 400 block of Park Street and found it hiding between a stretch of hallway between an apartment and a wall fence, according to a Presidio Police Department Facebook post. "It's uncommon for them to be found in areas where there are lots of people," said Rachel Connolly, the Texas Parks and Wildlife biologist for Presidio County. "It could just be that the animal was passing through and may have gotten confused or lost in town and wasn't able to find its way out. Or it may have been that it found an easy source of food in town." The police Facebook post noted that the mountain lion ran all the way through the city streets, crossing U.S. Highway 67, and finally running away into the wild. The post included a blurry photo of what appears to be the cat trying to leap a fence, along with photos of paw prints found later. A subsequent post advises, if you see a mountain lion, remain calm, pick up small children and pets, and back away slowly while maintaining eye contact with the lion. Do not turn and run. When given space to flee, the lion will most often leave human-dominated environments. Connolly urged residents to first report mountain lions to police if it is in an area with people, but also asked that all sightings be reported to a Texas Parks and Wildlife biologist. Search the web for TPWD Find a Wildlife Biologist, which will take you to a page to search for the appropriate person to contact, she said. As mediation stalls, Jeff Leach defamation case creeps forward. By Sam Karras. Sam at BigBendSentinel.com. Terlingua. A defamation case brought by Terlingua-based hotelier Jeff Leach against former employee Katie Milam inched forward this week after stalling in mediation since 2023. Counsel for Milam filed a partial motion for summary judgment, asking for a judge to rule in advance of a tentative September trial date. The complex legal battle between Leach and Milam, who goes by Schwartz in court filings, began in the summer of 2019 when Milam claims she was pinned down by her former employer, who told her he always gets what he wants. Milam filed a report with the Brewster County Sheriff's Office but declined to press charges. Leach filed a defamation lawsuit against Milam in September of that year, claiming that Milam's retelling of the incident to others had hurt his reputation and his business, short-term rental operation Base Camp Terlingua. Milam's counsel then filed a motion under the Texas Citizens Participation Act, TCPA, which provides a few criteria that courts can use to drop defamation suits, including whether or not a defendant was exercising their First Amendment rights or whether a particular plaintiff could be considered libel proof. The TCPA motion filed on the grounds that Milam had the First Amendment right to talk about what had happened between her and Leach and that Leach's alleged bad reputation rendered him liable proof, was granted by a court, but quickly appealed by Leach. The appeals court reversed the lower court's decision, citing missed deadlines and other procedural issues. While the civil suit was taking shape, three other women filed affidavits in support of Milam, alleging sexual violence and misconduct. One of them resulted in a grand jury indictment of Leach in February 2020 for sexual assault. The 83rd District Attorney's Office dismissed the indictment in April 2022. In July of that year, Milam filed her own countersuit and enjoined Leach's girlfriend, Anna Oakley. She alleged that the two had conspired to trash her reputation and cast doubt on her accusations, most notably by putting up stickers saying, "Katie lied," in bathrooms and bars across the Tri-County. The defense gathered hundreds of pages of testimony from others who accused Leach of predatory behavior and telling falsehoods, including articles in Texas Monthly alleging a long history of litigation and an article in the journal Science casting doubt on Leach's claim to be a PhD conducting research on the gut microbiome. Leach's counsel refuted these allegations throughout the discovery process. The two parties lingered in mediation throughout the end of 2023 until an impasse was declared in March of 2024. Malam's attorney, Jody Cole, filed a motion for summary judgment in hopes that a judge will find the facts of the case undisputed and make a decision from there. Cole's filing is a hybrid motion, applying only to Leach's case against Milam. If the judge rules in Milam's favor, her lawsuit against Leach will continue, seeking reimbursement of court costs and maximum damages of $1 million. Leach's attorney, Ray Leifest, said he didn't see much of a difference between Cole's most recent motion and the TCPA motion filed in 2020. Leifest will have 21 days to respond to the motion once set by the court and will have the opportunity to introduce additional discovery. "We're all anxious to get this resolved," he said. Cole wanted to stress that the decision to add Oakley to the proceedings was not meant as a personal attack, but to provide a full picture of all her client claims she suffered. "Jeff Leach is like a wad of gum on your shoe. You have to use a stick to get it off." This is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, April 18th, 2024, obituary. Kassler. John McKinley Kassler, known to many as Mac, passed away on April 2, 2024, after a tough battle with cancer. Born on October 25, 1950, in El Paso, to John and Gladys Kassler, Mac enjoyed his hometown days and graduated in 1969 from Burgess High School. He worked for the upstart office coffee firm for 10 years. In 1972, he married his high school sweetheart, Jody Kubin, on August 6th. In the early 80s, the couple moved to Holland, Texas, where Mac was a land surveyor as well as the superintendent of city utilities. The late 80s found Mac and Jody moving to Houston, where both were employed by UT Health Science Center. Having purchased land in Olympia Crossing in 1987, the couple decided in 1999 to make their home in Fort Davis. Mac was employed by UT McDonald's Observatory until 2004, then worked for Jeff Davis County as maintenance manager until retiring in 2009. Known for his generosity, storytelling, his daily trips to town, his love of grilling, chili competitions, his nicknames assigned to many, and his willingness to help others throughout the Davis Mountains, Mac will forever be remembered. Mac is preceded in death by his parents and older brother, Tom Kassler. He is survived by his wife, Jody, whom Mac lovingly called Sport, his brother Joe and wife Mary from Houston, and many nieces and nephews. A celebration of life is planned in the near future. Memorials or donations may be made in Mac's name to Pre-Born, P-R-E space B-O-R-N exclamation mark at symbol PREBORN.com, Wounded Warriors at symbol WoundedWarriorProject.org, or the charity of your choice. Oliver Memorial set for Saturday. A memorial for Gary Oliver, longtime Sentinel cartoonist, environmental activist, and community volunteer, will be held at the Marfa Public Library Courtyard on Saturday, April 20th, from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. In lieu of flowers, please consider a donation in his memory to the Friends of the Marfa Public Library.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.